Good morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ, at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on March 1st of 2023 under the headline, Body Snatchers Plotted to Steal Dead Mayor's Corpse. Today we have part two of this two-part story. Yesterday, in part one, we set the scene for this most ghoulish episode in Portland history, the scheme to dig up the body of town founder William Ladd and ransom it back to the family. We did the crime yesterday. Today we're going to go into how it was solved, with lightning speed, like within hours. Here we go. The whole scheme started to unravel right away. Detectives had taken a particular interest in the hay knife, and one of them had recognized the workmanship as being very similar to the work of a blacksmith he knew in Lake Oswego. So the Flatfoots lugged it over to his place to see if he recognized it. He sure did, he told them. He'd forged it to order for a farmer with a place down by the river, a man named, you guessed it, Daniel Magone. Meanwhile, State Senator George Brownell of Oregon City had been reading about the outrage in the morning papers, and it was reminding him of a very strange conversation he'd had a month earlier with a constituent. The constituent was asking him whether he thought Mr. Ladd's grave should be connected with electric wires, you know, for a sort of burglar alarm to protect it from grave robbers. The question had seemed silly at the time. After all, what medical college would buy the body of a well-known city founder for a dissection specimen? But on the morning of May 18th, after reading the article in the Oregonian, suddenly it didn't seem silly anymore. Brownell picked up his telephone and called the police. He gave them the name of the constituent who had asked him the odd question, a young man named, that's right, Charles Montgomery. Detectives were on their way to have a word with both men just a few hours later. Magone, as befitted the ringleader of such a gang, was silent as the very grave. I've always wanted to use that line in an Offbeat Oregon story, and now I had the chance. Anyway, silent as the very grave, and would not tell the cops a thing. But Montgomery, who, although already somewhat hard-boiled, was still young, cracked under questioning and copped to the rap. He then led the cops to the spot by the riverbank where he and Magone, with their hired helpers Rector and Long, had cached their, prize. Then he spilled the beans, very thoroughly, and this is the story that came out. Daniel Magone, at the time of Ladd's death, had been a wealthy and respected citizen. He had a valuable piece of farmland on the banks of the Willamette, about a mile and a half downstream from Oregon City, which he'd inherited from his father. He had a beautiful wife named Henrietta and an adorable young daughter. Life was good. Until suddenly, it wasn't. The depression known as the Panic of 1893 caught Magone at the worst possible time, and he found himself unable to make his mortgage payments, and he lost his farm. And then, 2 years into the depression, he lost his daughter, who drowned in the river before his eyes as he struggled to reach her and save her. This double blow seems to have sent Magone over the edge. He took to muttering darkly about how the fix was in and the rich were getting richer and the big spending elites needed to be made to pay. Many of his neighbors started avoiding him. One who did not was Charles Montgomery. Charlie, 22, was a much younger man than Magone, who was in his 40s, but Montgomery was also probably a little cracked, as evidenced by the murder charges. In any case, the two men became regular drinking buddies. One day, after the two of them had had supper together, Magone asked Montgomery to come out for a short walk with him. They strolled halfway across the Madison Street Bridge, and then, in the middle of the river, Magone stopped and took hold of Montgomery's coat.
"These are desperate, hard times, Charlie," he said, according to Montgomery's confession. "I don't know how we are going to get along, getting poorer all the time. I think if I can't get ahead some other way, pretty soon I'll go out to the cemetery and dig up Ladd's bones. I guess they'd give me something handsome to get them back. What do you think about it?
Montgomery did not at first think McGone was serious, but over the following months he learned that yes, he was. And although Montgomery did not at first want to get involved, the thought of the fabulous riches that they could shake the Ladd family down for finally brought him around. The sum McGone had in mind was $50,000, which would be worth $1.8 million in modern money. So McGone got everything ready. He stole the telephone from the train station and hid it near the graveyard, ready for use. He found a pair of laborers hungry enough to take on resurrection work, Rector and Long, telling them the corpses were those of paupers who were being exhumed to sell to the medical college as cadavers, and promising them each $50 for the night's work, the equivalent of about $1,800 in modern currency. Then came that supper at the Rheinpfalz, and that memorable stealthy trip to the graveyard, spades in hand. Before getting started, the resurrection gang slipped up to the Ladd home, which was adjacent to Riverview Cemetery. William Ladd had actually been one of the cemetery's founders. There, Montgomery tapped the phone line out of the Ladd house, attaching it to the stolen telephone so that he would know if an alarm were given. Then, leaving Montgomery there to listen on the phone, the other three went to the grave.
McGone's first step was to stoop over the grave and slash about its borders with a hay knife, the Oregonian's reporter wrote. I guess that will fix their burglar alarm, he said.
Then the four of them got busy with their shovels.
They worked more furiously as they realized what the consequences might be, McGone growing frenzied as they reached the coffin, the Oregonian reporter recounts. He turned around several times and thrust his pistol before him into the darkness at a fancied sound, then replaced it in his pocket and worked like a fiend.
Finally, they got the casket out on the grass, and McGone hacked it open with the hay knife. Considering Ladd had been dead for nearly 4 years, the patriarch's mortal remains were in tip-top condition. They had, of course, been very carefully embalmed, so at least he wasn't smelly or falling apart. But Ladd was a big and heavy man, and being prosperous, was very well fed. The four lads struggled to wrangle their heavy burden down the steep hillside to where their getaway boat lay tied up by the river. And by the time they were there, they were too exhausted to go back for their second intended prize, the much fresher body of the late Mr. Lewis. Lewis was also a wealthy Portland merchant, although not of the same social prominence as Ladd. The four of them were so exhausted, and the morning was now drawing so near, that they just dumped the body into the boat and cast off, leaving all their tools behind in the graveyard for the detectives to find. And in so doing, of course, they more or less sealed their legal doom. In court, Montgomery pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Rector's attorney, S.H. Gruber, had a good deal to say, but he had to be somewhat delicate about it. The thing was, because body snatching is illegal, it didn't really matter, legally speaking, that Rector basically went through with the corpse-snapping scheme at gunpoint. Since he knew very well that stealing corpses for medical experiments was against the law, a point that he couldn't very well dispute, being as the operation was undertaken with great stealth in the middle of the night, the fact that he thought he was helping steal a less important corpse for a less unpopular purpose was really no defense at all. Nonetheless, his attorney made that case to the judge. The judge patiently explained that it would not help his client. The attorney thanked him and withdrew it. Then the real audience for Gruber's speech went back to the newsroom and wrote the story up. Gruber's client was going to jail. That was clear and unavoidable. But at least his neighbors and his wife's friends would know it wasn't entirely his fault. Although Montgomery and Rector both cooperated with authorities, and neither McGone nor Long would speak a word, in the end all four men ended up drawing the same sentence. 2 years. The charge was illegal disinterment.
Luckily for them, it wasn't blackmail or a ransom or a kidnapping yet, or extortion, because they hadn't even had time to write a note to the Ladd family, said Oregon Historical Society Executive Director Carrie Timchuk in an interview with KGW's Ashley Corsleen for an episode of the Wicked West podcast. Their thought was that they were going to hold it for ransom, but they were so awful at what they did that they left too much evidence. I guess that was the good thing for them, was that they were found out quickly. Otherwise, they would have spent a longer time in prison.
McGone's trial took a while, because he was so obviously unhinged, and the question of insanity had to be doped out. Was he crazy enough to need to go to the asylum rather than the prison? In the end, the answer was no, and he ended up finishing his 2 years in the regular penitentiary. He'd already served 16 months of it by then, waiting for trial, as did the other three. As far as I've been able to learn, none of them got into any further trouble after they were released. And as for the Ladd family, they purchased a new coffin to replace the one Magone had hacked up. They laid their patriarch to rest in it and reburied him. But this time they dug an extra wide hole, and instead of filling it back in with dirt, they poured it full of concrete. It seems a pretty safe bet that no grave robber, resurrection man, body snatcher, or ghoul has disturbed old Mr. Ladd's long-suffering bones since. Key sources in this story have included works by Ashley Corsleen and the Archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People of Old Oregon, and more. Eventually the plan is for 8 of them, although how many are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf, hint, hint. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m. So, yeah, it'll be a couple days before you get your next fix, but I don't have to tell you that Monday morning will be here in the blink of an eye, do I? So yeah, that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. And now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.